30% chance for showers today, highs in 90. Then the winds turn around to the north, which has a little bit to do with Helene going into Florida and what's causing it to go into Florida. But northerly winds, lower humidity, highs of 86. Friday should have a kind of fall feel to it, which is nice. Saturday and Sunday, highs between 85 and 90, but dry. And if you head into Atlanta on Sunday, the major concern, as I understand it, for the storm would be the airport. And we'll talk more about that as the week progresses, because some people are going to be heading to Atlanta for the Saints-Falcons game. The good news, though, is that Helene is not going to cause us any problems at all. It is currently 6:13, and we talk about the presidential race because, in a way, it's 40-something days away. In another way, it's already begun. But it is a big old giant deal, right? So we talk about it every day, and I Google latest on presidential race, and I see a couple of different polls, and some of them say Trump's leading, some of them say Harris is leading. I guess it depends on what source you go to. With that, we welcome in our friend Aaron Dusso, who is an associate professor of political science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Who's leading? Can you tell or not? And where are they leading? And how do you make sense of all of this?
If you look at the national polls, it would suggest that probably Harris has a small lead of maybe 2 to 3 points, but that's still within the margin of error. So, but that's obviously not what matters. And to use a cliche, this is a historically close election. I mean, we have, it looks like, 7 states where it's too close to call. And so we are up in the air. It's a coin toss.
Is this the new norm when it comes to presidential elections?
I don't think it will be going forward. I think Donald Trump, as a political presence, has so solidified what people feel and think, you know, so they either like him or they don't. And so that isn't changing. I mean, at this point, no one is changing their mind about Donald Trump. They are solid on it. And we see that reflected in the polls. It just stays. We don't see wild swings anymore.
So with that being said, are we talking about people who have not made up their mind about Donald Trump or Kamala Harris in swing states, or people that care enough to go out and vote? How do you parse those numbers?
This is going to be a turnout. I think this is where polls can miss, because part of the art of polling is trying to figure out, you know, and predict what the electorate's going to look like in November. Mm-hmm. And the closer we get to it, the easier it is to do that. But they rely on certain questions in their polls to try and predict who's going to show up. And so people say, yes, I'm likely to show up, or I'm very likely to show up, but that doesn't mean they're going to. And they might change their mind over the course of the next, 40-some days. So that's where polls tend to, find their miss. And that's where both Trump and Harris have to get their people out to vote, because that's going to be the thing that can change the outcome.
Is there anybody that is truly, or I don't know how you're going to answer this question, but do surveys, polls, et cetera, political scientists think that there's anybody that is still undecided as to whether or not they favor Kamala Harris or Donald Trump? And if so, what is that likely to turn on their decision 40 days from now, if they're not allowed to early vote?
Right. Yeah. Polling suggests that there is probably this 4, maybe 5% of people that still say they're undecided.
Undecided, right, Professor?
Yeah, they say it. Right. Yeah, they say it that they're undecided. What they really feel, we're not sure. But typically, that undecided group will then start to break. Usually it's actually larger than it is right now. But, typically it'll break maybe a week or two prior to the election. And that's oftentimes hard for polls to pick up, because you only see it in those last week. So what they decide on, though, is oftentimes just feeling, and these individuals typically are going to be the people who are the least educated about politics, least interested in politics, and they're still going to show up for reasons that might be simply as habit. And so what they actually decide on typically is just, how do I feel? So that last week, the last few days before the election, how am I feeling? Does the country feel good? Do people seemingly talking more about Harris or more about Trump and in a positive way in the sphere of people I have around me? And then they just go do it.
So with that being said, we always talk about October surprises, right? Is there anything that can come out on either candidate that would surprise anybody?
It's hard to imagine that anything's going to come out on, certainly on Donald Trump, that would surprise people. I mean, he's been looked at as, he's been convicted of crime. So what can happen, I can't imagine. Now, Harris is different, because Harris hasn't been in the spotlight that as long as Donald Trump has, and hasn't been had as many opportunities for, you know, the opposition to release their opposition research. So theoretically, if I was going to predict there's going to be some big surprise, I would bet it's going to happen on the Harris side. Now, I don't know of anything that could possibly happen, but that's the more, opportunity, the more gray area.
And it's a topsy-turvy world anyway, because anything negative about Trump actually helps him with his supporters, right?
Right, yeah. His supporters aren't changing. It does not matter what comes out. His supporters are not changing. That's why I talk about, you know, how kind of locked in we are right now. You know, in a world in the future where Donald Trump's not a part of the political process, I think that we change and we might revert back to a more, you know, fluid situation where people do actually, you know, open their minds to opposition. But right now, people are locked in with Trump.
I'm seeing a story here about wishy-washy Republican voters who say, and I know a lot of Republican leaders have come out against the former president, but when it comes to voters, they might be a little wishy-washy, but when it comes right down to it, and they might identify themselves as independent, although not registered that way, and they say it doesn't matter what letters behind the name, I vote for the best person. But when it comes right down to it, inevitably they default back to the R or the D, do they not?
Yeah, that's actually by far the most likely scenario. A book came out back in the 90s called The Myth of the Independent Voter. And what that demonstrated was that people who answer and say that they're independent on questions in the polls, typically, if you follow up with them, you'll find that they actually lean one way or the other. And then their behavior is very much like anyone who identifies with that party. So they become, you know, strong of voters for that party as someone who said originally, yes, I'm very strong Republican or Democrat.
I want to talk about down ballot races, et cetera, everything else that's up for grabs in the different states when we come back, because I think that's getting ignored. And we were talking yesterday about how sometimes people say they're going to sit out the presidential race because they don't like either candidate. But what they don't realize is if the garbage doesn't get picked up, or if for whatever reason your street floods or this doesn't happen or that doesn't happen, the White House isn't going to help you. It's going to be your council person that helps you, or the representative, or what have you. So we'll continue the conversation with Aaron Dusso. We come back, 504-260-1870. Meanwhile, you can text me at 504-260-1870. And let me know, do you know of anybody that is truly undecided when it comes to this presidential election? Because somebody texted in and said, if you're still undecided, then you have something wrong with you. I'm sure they're looking at it, I would think, from one way or the other, thinking that if you don't vote for my person, well, then something's wrong with you. Of course, the person that favors the other candidate would say, if you don't vote for my person, then something's wrong with you. 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis, about the presidential election 40 days away, but early voting already underway. How many states, Professor, do you know? I don't mean to catch you flat-footed here. I was just wondering.
I think there's three of them going on right now.
And that's going to continue, I guess, to increase as we get closer and closer?
Yeah, usually most states will start like a month ahead of time. So like in Indiana, you're talking October 8th is when we can start doing it in person. So that's pretty common.
I get texts every now and then from people, and I don't know which side it's on, but they always say that there's going to be this groundswell of support, that it's going to be that it's flying beneath the polls, that it's going to be a blowout for either Harris or Trump. And every political scientist I speak to says, that's probably not going to happen, but it's wishful thinking. Your thoughts on that?
Right. I mean, this is what I would tell people who live in their partisan bubble, right? Republican or Democrat. Mm-hmm. You watch this stuff, you hear this stuff, and you begin to believe that, oh, this is what's really going on. And the polls have just never reflected any type of major lead, at least since Harris. I mean, before, when Biden was still, Trump was looking like he was going to, you know, win in a landslide. Mm-hmm. But, you know, now it is extremely close. Polling just isn't confirming any of those beliefs in that bubble right now. And if we're going to see it, we should start to move pretty quickly here if we're going to really see that kind of landslide.
Somebody texted in, I think it's a good question about polling, and how do you draw a line between electoral votes or popular votes, or how does the polling take that into consideration?
So this is a problem, and this is why, you know, it's, you know, pollsters have got an egg on their face, is that so much of the focus is on national polls, which then, you know, ask people across, you know, state borders, and we look at that and we see Harris is maybe up 2, maybe 3 points. Back in 2016, Clinton was up 9 points, and you thought, well, there's no way she can lose. But the reality is we don't have one election. We have 50 elections in every state. And so what we really need is polling at the state level, where the population that we're looking at and we're trying to, you know, predict is just that one state. And that doesn't happen as often. It's much less common. So even in these battleground states, you might get two polls here, a poll there. You don't get them over and over again like you get, you know, daily tracking polls, you know, at the national level. And so this leads us to make, you know, incorrect assumptions. The rule of thumb is that the national, if you're just only paying attention to that national poll, the rule of thumb is typically if one candidate's up by 5 points, that's where you can begin to think, okay, that's really meaningful even at the state level.
You know, whenever you make a bet on a football game, the inside people are always looking for any inside information. Does this guy have a sore leg? Does that one have a sore shoulder? Do you have any kind of any tea leaves you're trying to read to give you an insight into this, Aaron?
Well, one thing, you know, with Pennsylvania being seemingly is going to be the linchpin, paying attention to registration can maybe send a signal. And Republicans have been gaining in registration for decades, right? So if you go back 20 or 30 years, Pennsylvania was overwhelmingly registered as a Democrat. It was million-plus advantage. And at this point, Republicans are going to be able to get it down to only 300,000, you know, advantage for Democrats, and they continue to gain, particularly in the rural counties in Pennsylvania, outside of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. So that kind of thing, where Republicans have continued to do that ground game, get people registered, get them registered, then ultimately get them to the polls, that is showing right now an advantage for Republicans.
So when it comes to traditionally ground games, better ground games, is it on Republican side, Democratic side, or does it depend on what state you're in?
It usually depends on which state. And, you know, in Pennsylvania, you know, this is really not about the Trump, you know, campaign doing the ground game. This is really about the state party. And they've been working at this now for decades, you know, where they've been building out this attempts to register people and get them to the polls. So it's not just about the campaign itself having offices and knocking on doors. It's really about the state parties. And if your state party is weak or, you know, in a state, you're really in big trouble at the national level.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time. Have a good day. Aaron Dusso, Associate Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Indianapolis. I'll also ask you on the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Are you emotional about this presidential race at all, or have you just figured, you know what, whatever happens, happens, and I'm not getting involved in all of the bubbles? 6:30 now, time for WWL First News. 6:44, 16 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Donald Lane, a former Secret Service agent, to talk about protection around former President Trump. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Good to be back with you.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me what's going on here. It just, you know, I'm reading a story here from NBC News. Secret Service is heightening security around former President Donald Trump, they said Monday. Well, you would think it's about time, right? I mean, I don't understand quite what's going on here. Talk to me about it, Donald.
Yeah, you know, obviously after the first assassination attempt, and who would ever think we would be talking about, you know, first and second assassination attempt? It's extraordinary. I believe, you know, the detail was beefed up after that. However, you had this incident that occurred on an off-the-record movement, an OTR, you know, which further heightened people's awareness of what's going on and concern for what the Secret Service is doing. I think, you know, obviously there were some issues with the first attempt and the second attempt. Certainly the agent took appropriate action and did what he did. I think people are wondering, you know, why was this guy allowed to lie in wait for the time he did? And, you know, I think the answers to those questions will come out in time. The bottom line, though, is that, you know, he didn't have the full complement like you would have, you know, for a presidential visit. And it's difficult oftentimes to fully secure an OTR. You do have the advantage, though, that normally people don't know you're going there. So hopefully they'll continue to beef it up and there won't be any further incidents moving forward.
I wanted to ask you about that. Like when the president goes to play golf, any president, President Trump or whomever, I mean, somebody has to know, right? The people at the golf course have to know. How do they handle a security event like that or an outing like that, if you will? Not a security event, but an outing.
Yeah, it really just depends on what type of function it is. If he's going golfing with other people and it's on his schedule, And it's something that's known about, that would be, more of a public event. Not necessarily that everyone would know, but a lot more people than if it was a spur of the moment, off the record type event. So, if it's the first one, then you have the full complement of security. You have an advance, a security advance that gets there, days before, if not a week before, to work with facility folks and other folks, to work with the military to completely secure the area. If it's the latter, a spur of the moment thing, you may have, a few minutes to get there ahead of time. But again, in those cases, usually the threat is seriously reduced because nobody does know that he's going.
Is there one that's safer than the other? I would think maybe the unannounced would be safer. I don't know.
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, typically that would be safer. If you're an assassin, you're going to have to know where the person you want to assassinate is going to be. If you don't know, make it very difficult to pull something like that off. I think in the case of the second attempt, this guy was extremely determined and he waited there, for an extraordinary amount of time.
I guess it goes back to Archduke Ferdinand, whatever it was, with that assassination attempt where sometimes stuff
right.
just does happen, right?
Well, and that's the nature of the job of the Secret Service. It's a very demanding job because, it's difficult to completely and fully secure a person if they have to be out in the public. And let's face it, our presidents, our politicians need to be out in the public. They're public figures. They lead our nation. And so it's always going to present problems. How do you adequately protect them? I think the Secret Service historically has done a good job overall, an excellent job in doing that. If you consider the amount of trips and visits and events that need to be secured over time, of course, it's 100% success, though. And when you don't have that, you're going to draw scrutiny.
How hard is it to find people that are qualified to work on a presidential protection detail? And I would presume, I was always under the impression that if you're the Democratic nominee or the Republican nominee and it was a presidential election, you're pretty much treated the same as far as security goes. At what point do you get security briefings? Do you know that, sir, or not?
In terms of the how often does the protectee get it?
It's two different questions, I guess. I kind of blended them together. I guess I'm thinking if you're the nominee, maybe. I don't know if you get security briefings until you're elected, but at some point when the security briefings start, then you have access to information, and from kidnap or anything else, you need to be protected as much as. I'm kind of blending a lot of stuff here, Donald. I don't mean to do that. And you can answer after the break because we got traffic coming up. But I guess what I'm wondering is, you would think at some point the both would be treated equally, right? But maybe that's not the case.
Right.
And the other question is, when it comes to finding people that are qualified to be on a presidential protection detail, because I'm guessing not everybody with the Secret Service qualifies for that. We'll talk about what's being done, and what is required to find people that are qualified to serve on a presidential protection detail, whether it's on the nominee side or the presidential side. We'll sort all of that out. We come back 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:55 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Donald Lane, former Secret Service agent, about the Secret Service boosting protection around former President Trump. And we're asking about when it comes to, and let me start with this question, Donald, in the time we have left. When it comes to finding agents that are qualified to be on a presidential protection detail, and I don't know if there's a difference in the bar when it comes to a presidential candidate or a president themselves or a vice president, how do you determine who's qualified to be on what detail?
Well, you would have certain, standards that people would have to meet for instance, for the president's detail. Some physical standards, has someone been hurt on the job prior to that? That could present problems and things like that. Also, excellence in the work that you've done, showing an aptitude for protection, those types of things. So it's really a case-by-case, basis to make sure that the agent is ready for that challenge, usually, 4 to 5 years into an agent's career.
Not every, obviously, as you just said, not every Secret Service agent, because, and talk a little bit, if you will, about what the Secret Service does in addition to protect the president, because I think sometimes people think that's all they do, and that's not all they do at all.
No, no. The Secret Service was founded as an investigative agency in the wake of the Civil War because of all of the counterfeit that was running around the country. And so for, you know, the majority of the agency's tenure at the beginning, they were an investigative agency. And then due to their proximity, literally, the Secret Service building was across from the White House. They began to help out with White House protection. And over time, that just morphed into full-time protection. So it's a dual-role agency.
That's interesting. That's how it started. That's how it got into the presidential protection business.
That's right, yes.
Wow. So moving forward, when you look at, and a president, former president tweeted something about Iran, when it comes to foreign governments being calling for presidents to be assassinated, et cetera, is the job of the Secret Service becoming more complicated, or is it always been what it has been?
Yeah, I think it's always been what it has been. I think what you're seeing in this case, Tommy, is the fact that you have a, you know, it's unusual to have a candidate who has already been president, and then in this case, not just a candidate, a very, you know, divisive candidate. I mean, there's a lot of folks who love Donald Trump, and there's a whole lot of folks who don't love Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a unique challenge this particular election cycle.
Looking back on the thing that happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, and I asked you this before, but going back to Lee Harvey Oswald, and I know it's, you know, you can't, it's two separate independent events, but when you consider that it was just a breach of security, I'm guessing that allowed the guy to get that close in Butler, that this troubled loner could get that close to killing somebody like Donald Trump. Does it surprise you that maybe Lee Harvey Oswald just unfolded as it did and that there was no mass security, what's the word I'm thinking of? Conspiracy.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, for the Lee Harvey Oswald incident with Kennedy, you know, there was a lot less protection back then. A lot of things weren't considered.
The route was
published? Time and place.
Right. Route was published?
Yeah. Back then, the route was published. You know, there were a lot of differences. Every time that there's an incident, the Secret Service learns something, and they usually come away doing something different, you know, that enhances security. So I have no doubt that'll be the case with this particular incident.
Thank you. I appreciate your insight. Donald Lane, former Secret Service agent. And again, it just, this whole Butler, Pennsylvania thing changed my mind on the Kennedy assassination, because I'm thinking, well, if knowing what they know now, it could happen now, then maybe it just happened then. We'll be back. 7:44, 16 till 8. Very valuable information from Kevin Gilmore at the National Weather Service. And again, you don't want to wish anything on anybody else, but I can only imagine the disruption that we would have here if something like Helene were to come barreling in, especially on the heels of Francine. With that, we welcome in Dub Lane, Walter Dub Lane, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. How you doing, Dub?
Hey, good morning, Tommy. I'm fine.
Tell me about this dock worker strike. What's going on with this?
Well, again, this is a national, well, not a national, a regional strike of the East Coast and Gulf Coast dock workers, which is a pretty big deal. The West Coast people have a different union, and they had one back in 2007. This hasn't happened for several decades. And it potentially could be very, very disruptive in many different ways. Because, I mean, if we just think back of what happened, you know, during the COVID, mm-hmm. when because of COVID, you know, things, the docks shut down out in Los Angeles and stuff, and then all of a sudden the supply chains across the country got messed up and people couldn't get supplies, they couldn't get materials, things of that sort. The docks, obviously, are where so much stuff comes in and out, and it's not just the immediate effect on the dock workers, but again, if they can't unload the steamships, then, you know, the truckers don't need to have a job. And so there's lots of other things down the line. But the key thing is all of those supplies that are either going into the country, out of the country, are going to be sitting in these ships or sitting on the docks waiting to be loaded and backing up. And once they start backing up, it takes quite a, you know, for any day, the estimate is for any one day that the docks are shut down, these big container ships, it could take 5 days to fix the problem.
For most of us, you know, we do the bypass on Chapultepec Street, or we go down and it's behind the wall and we don't know what's going on behind there. How busy is the port of New Orleans, and where does that stand when it comes to, I don't know, I even measure it in terms of cargo or whatever with the union, in terms of percentage of either cargo handled or employees involved as it relates to this union and this potential strike that could happen on September 30th?
Well, the Port of New Orleans directly affects about almost like 20,000 jobs, but the people that are going on strike is a very small percentage of that. Like up in Baton Rouge, it's only like 8 people for their port, but in New Orleans, it's a much bigger one, particularly that big container port on Napoleon. Mm-hmm. That's a huge one, and again, so it affects, you know, just. It's a major driver of our local economy. You know, we also usually talk about it's not one of the top 3 or 4, but it's very much on the list of one of the drivers of the economy. And if that thing starts shutting down, and what the key thing is, not just what it affects us locally, is that the Port of New Orleans is, I think, well, it's the number one break bulk port in the United States, meaning all those grains and stuff that are growing up in Iowa and Minnesota that come down the Mississippi River and loaded onto ships for the rest of the world. That's our number one cargo. We do a lot of chemicals as well, petroleum, and then there's other things that come in and out of the port. But, you know, if that grain all starts getting backed up, then we're not going to be able to ship that out. That's going to hurt the farmers all up the middle of the country. And the ports in the east, are going to affect, the things that come in. Right now is when retailers are bringing their Christmas materials in. Uh-huh. And if that gets backed up, you know, we might not have Christmas, you know, or at least a certainly diminished one.
You mean a dock workers' strike could cancel Christmas, Dub? Is that what you're telling me? Wow.
Well, obviously that's clearly an exaggeration.
Quite a shock to the young men and women going to school early. Kids, relax. Santa Claus will still come. Well, I don't want Dub to get you all freaked out or anything here, but it is important that they hammer out an agreement. You know,
it is the case. If it was a strike that lasts, you know, more than a week or two, then it really could mean that some of the things that the big Christmas items won't make it to the shelves. Not it's going to close Christmas, but
I know. I'm just kidding with you. I'm just tugging you.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Well, when it comes to the nature, and I know you're not a shop steward or anything with the International Longshoremen's Association, but you know, you look at and I like old movies because I studied film at UNO with Steve Hanks was his name, I think, if I remember correctly. You think of the movies with the guys with the on the waterfront with the hooks and the sacks and all of that. The nature of that work has changed greatly. It's all container now for the most part, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean these guys are running cranes and these big things mostly these days. There's not much hauling things on your shoulder anymore.
So I guess when it comes to the nature of the union agreement. Louisiana is a right to work state, but how the port agrees to do business with the union? Explain that to me if you know.
Well, again, it's the matter of if the people that are running those cranes just walk off, then the cranes don't get running. And although if I read correctly, the local group has already had kind of an agreement, but they still are bound by the international group. Mm-hmm. And so if the international longshoremen, go on strike, that then local people will honor that strike. And so it's just about if it may not be a huge number of people, but if they don't work, the ships don't get loaded and unloaded.
I was just wondering how hard.
Especially the container ships.
I was wondering
that's a big part of our local port.
How hard it would be to replace them when it comes to grain operator, not grain operator, when it comes to crane operators, how specialty of a job that is, or you don't know.
These are skilled positions these days, and they make a fairly decent salary.
Do you have any idea what the salary is?
One of the problems is that they're asking for more money. That's always what the strike is about. Mm-hmm. But they're also asking that we not basically replace these guys with AI or with machines. That's the bigger issue, that, you know, they're trying to protect their jobs. And I understand why they would do that, but that's a huge issue. The doc is not going to agree to that because, you know, we see that every place else, that, you know, robots are replacing people where they can, and there's reason for that. But, you know, so trying to protect, I mean, this is historical things with unions. I like to tell my students that for 30 years, we had cabooses on trains for the sole reason of hauling the caboosemen who no longer had a job because the labor unions require that every train have, you know, a crew of six people, one of which is rides in the caboose. And so they pulled the caboose long after technology had removed the reason for the caboosemen. So, you know, those type of inefficiencies are just really bad for the economy. Now, I understand why the workers want that, but it's a problem.
You know, I learn something every time I talk to you, Dub, and that caboose thing is new. I did not know that, but that's why I love talking to you. 7:52, we'll pick it up here. We come back. I want to talk about the nature of, from the economic standpoint, Dub, of a strike. If anybody ever wins a strike, I don't know what they do, and I always hearken back to Bayou Steel and what happened there. Walter Dub Lane's our guest, associate professor of economics and finance at UNO, talking about a potential international longman's association, a dock workers strike, a longshoremen's association strike that could affect potentially Christmas and supply chain, and we all know what a mess COVID caused with that 7:52, 8 till 8. I'll get it out eventually. Tommy Tucker, traffic now, WWL. 7:58, 2 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back to Walter Dub Lane, a friend, associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO. I'll say it again. Clancy Dubose was the first one to say it, but UNO built the middle class of the city. Newell Norman, Diane Newman, who runs the place, myself, all graduates of UNO, and I can't thank the university enough for what they've done for me. Walter, that being said, let's talk about the economic effects of a strike. Does anybody ever really win a strike?
Well, in the short run, all the evidence says that everybody loses.
That's
because, you know, the strike workers lose income while they're on strike. Now, the idea is they're behind it is, well, then when if I get a $5,000, $10,000 raise and $5,000 raise over the next 5 years, I'll make up the money I lost. But in the short run, and then, of course, the company loses because they're shut down. They can't sell anything, and they may make it up some of it up later. But the reason for the strikes are really twofold. One time, sometimes it's just psychological. The labor and management just, you know, have this match where nobody can actually reach an agreement. But so the other one is more long-term. The idea is the only thing that workers have to bargain with is the threat of a strike. You know, when you're asking for more money, if I don't give it to you, what are you going to do? The answer is, well, the only thing they can do is strike. So sometimes they have to strike every once in a while so that maybe 4 years from now, when they bargain again and they threaten, that the people will believe them that they really will do it. If they don't think they'll ever do it, then they don't. It really reduces their bargaining power. So in the long run, workers might actually have some benefit from striking now in terms of not how much they get now, but how much it affects their bargaining power in the future.
Thank you, Dub. Appreciate your time. We'll be back talking to David Hammer about Lawrence Hecker's trial, or lack thereof. It's 8:15 now on this Wednesday morning. David Hammer joins us, our friend, WWL Louisiana chief investigative reporter, to talk about this, I guess I can call him a rapist, a self-admitted rapist. David, I don't want to get in trouble here with, and I know you're not my attorney, but he did admit that he assaulted this kid, right? These kids?
Well, no, let's just be clear on that. Real quick. I mean, Lawrence Hecker has confessed on camera with me and Ramon Vargas from The Guardian to molesting several children. He always said that it was willing, that these kids were willing to have sex with him in the 60s and 70s. And that's the distinction between what he's charged with now, which is rape, which is that he allegedly choked out and raped a kid while he was unconscious in 1975. There's a difference there simply in that you cannot prosecute someone for molestation anymore for something that happened in the 60s or 70s, you can prosecute someone for rape, for forcible first-degree rape. So that's the distinction there. It's a legal distinction. He has, like you said, admitted several times in writing, on camera with us, that he has sexually abused children. And can you imagine, Tommy, being one of those victims who finally see him being brought to justice, being brought to a trial yesterday, and only to have the judge, Benedict Willard, recuse himself at the last moment? It was a pretty shocking scene yesterday in the courtroom.
Why at the last moment? Because I can understand, okay, you know, the tentacles of the Catholic Church, you can say it however you want, that can be, I guess maybe that's a pejorative way to say it. Maybe the Catholic Church touches a lot of lives, you can say it that way if you want. But either way, this judge had to know that he had a conflict before, long before Hecker showed up in the courtroom. Accurate?
Well, we don't know what this conflict is exactly. We do have some references from the prosecutor, Ned McGowan, to a previous incident about a month ago in court in a different case where this judge, Benedict Willard, got into it with this prosecutor, Ned McGowan, in a completely separate case in which one of the jurors allegedly made come-ons to one of the assistant district attorneys, talked about her being beautiful and things like that. And when
Hang on, I got to use the timeout here. Go back, David.
Yeah,
please.
This is a completely separate case. It was a rape case involving something not unrelated to the church stuff, unrelated to this priest. And when they were in court and when the jury was seated, one of the jurors allegedly made comments, advances toward one of the assistant district attorneys from the special victims unit. And when the district attorney's office raised concerns to the judge had the woman from the district attorney's office removed from the courtroom. And Ned McGowan, who's the first assistant district attorney who's prosecuting the Hecker case and was in the courtroom on that case, raised concerns about it. Judge Willard held him in contempt and said that he was being disrespectful. That was about a month ago. So if the origination of this conflict between the judge and the first assistant district attorney that affects the Hecker case started a month ago, he also could have said something then. There were multiple times that McGowan was in Willard's courtroom since then, and he's not recused himself from any of those cases. And now here he is recusing himself. Also, adding to the complications yesterday was that Hecker was not in court. He didn't show up because he had been transferred to the hospital with the UTI, a urinary tract infection. And so the district attorney's office is extremely frustrated, but mostly the victims, including the victim in this case, who made the allegations back in 1975 and was ignored when he was a kid, that he had been choked out and raped by Hecker. He is extremely upset, as you can imagine. And there were dozens of victims who weren't even among Hecker's victims, who were really looking to this trial to finally hold a priest accountable for his admitted crimes. And now it's being delayed yet again. It's being moved to a new court. Judge Nandi Campbell now has it. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't just start over from square one. But this priest, Lawrence Hecker, is 93 years old. He has mild to moderate dementia. And, it, you know, compared to a year ago when Ramon and I were interviewing him at his doorstep and he was answering all our questions in the heat for 18 minutes, he apparently has gone downhill physically and mentally. And so, you know, they're losing their chances to get this person on trial for his alleged crimes.
Look, I don't want to, you know, get off into a foreign territory here or anything, because I know this is about the victims of this pedophile priest and his trial and the just maneuverings that have gone on to avoid him facing justice. But I just got to go back to this. It's a rape trial, and a juror tries to pick up on an assistant district attorney from the Survivors Victims Unit, SVU, and makes inappropriate comments to her, I'm presuming, accurate? Correct me if I said anything
wrong. That's what's been reported. That's what's in the court filings. Absolutely, yes.
And the judge, instead of dismissing the juror, dismisses the assistant district attorney. Is that what I'm hearing?
That is correct. And then has Mr. McGowan and the lead prosecutor on that case also removed when they started making objections in court and asking him to put what was said in a conference on the record in the court record. And, you know, that's the type of thing that has led to this point now in a completely separate case where he's saying that the district attorney's office is being disrespectful and he's recusing himself at the last minute just as they're about to see the jury to go to trial after a year-long process of getting to this point. So it is pretty shocking development in this case.
So you can understand, while this is not about Hecker, how that would get my attention, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it should get everybody's attention, Tommy. I mean, you know, this judge is an elected official, and, you know, we need to get some kind of an explanation here beyond what we have from the court records, because that's all we have to go on at this point. And to have that kind of recusal without an explanation beyond just, you know, the back and forth in an open courtroom setting is very difficult to understand.
So a month ago, there's a rape case. A juror on a rape case that has been seated makes inappropriate comments to an assistant district attorney with the SVU, and the judge's response is to have that assistant district attorney and other representatives of the district attorney's office removed rather than dismissing the juror. The judge is Benedict Willard. Section C, criminal district court judges, elections have consequences, which led to him now, as of yesterday, recusing himself in this Lawrence Hecker trial because saying there would be a conflict when this happened a month ago and the trial was on the docket to start yesterday. Did I say anything wrong?
That is a perfect summary.
Okay. We'll pick it up. We come back. 823, traffic now, WWL. 828, Tommy Tucker, WWL. A couple of minutes back with David Hammer, WWL Louisiana chief investigative reporter, about this travesty that's going on with Lawrence Hecker. So what happens from here now? First of all, I think it's interesting when you talked about Jason Williams and his frustration yesterday, David.
Yeah, I mean, he's frustrated. He's frustrated on behalf of the various victims that he's representing by bringing this case forward. I have to say, you know, whatever you think about Jason Williams politically or his, you know, the way he's handled criminal cases in other realms, he really has taken this effort further than his predecessors have. In fact, even the defense attorney, Eugene Redman, who represents Lawrence Hecker, said these charges should have been brought against my client a long, long time ago. So, you know, Jason Williams is the DA who finally brought these charges after, you know, years and years of documented cases about Lawrence Hecker. And so to have this up to the very last moment with Williams prepared himself to argue the case and to have this happen over this kind of side issue that doesn't seem to have anything to do with this case is extremely frustrating for him. And to put this into context too, in the whole Catholic Church sex abuse scandal, to know that you've had these cases like Dino Chanel, George Grignack, Patrick Watney, these priests and deacons who were on the verge of trial, and then at the last minute, there's either a deal or they die while they're awaiting trial, and now you have a 93-year-old Lawrence Hecker who played such a key role in the state police's larger investigation of the Catholic Church priest abuse cover-up. For that to get to this point and not go to trial on the day of trial is extremely frustrating. So we'll see what happens, because the prosecution is going to try to get this heard very, very quickly in Judge Nambi Campbell's court, hopefully not having to start over at square one, but get right into a trial. But we'll see if that happens.
Thank you, David. Appreciate your time and your work as always. You know that. David Hammer, WWL Louisiana Chief Investigative Reporter. And I would just ask anybody, and this is my opinion here, if any Fortune 500 company were to be protecting an employee or these shenanigans were going on with the employee of a Fortune 500 company, what would your response be? Not to mention an archdiocese. Right now it's time for WWL First News. 8:47, 13 till 9. Everybody come on in, settle down, have a seat. This is Internet Security / Data Breach 101. I'm the graduate assistant, Tommy Tucker, on WWL. Professor Alex Hammerstone joins us now, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing quite well. How about yourself?
I'm okay. I thought it'd be a good idea to have an Internet Security Data Breach 101 every now and then, because there are new scams out there every day, I'm sure, as you and I. Matter of fact, let me ask you that, Alex Hammerstone. As you and I speak right now, unbeknownst to us or whomever it is that's being breached, there is a data breach occurring. Would you bet on that? Would you say that's accurate?
I would say yes, and especially because a lot of times the data breaches are ongoing and last for months, and so they tend to overlap, and it's pretty common that they're happening, but also that attackers are out there kind of day in and day out plying their trade and, you know, getting our information and getting into our accounts.
You're a well-read guy. You do this for a living. I know this is not what you came on to talk about. May or may not be in your wheelhouse, but when it comes to presidential election, election integrity and so forth, do you have any concerns or not? I mean, this is your life's work, what you do, you know, for a living.
So I think the question is probably specific to a lot of the electronic things. That's what we tend to get asked about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly these systems are reviewed. You know, I've got friends that have worked on boards of elections, and, you know, certainly at least on a local level, you know, if they're all kind of bipartisan. They take their work very seriously. But, you know, certainly it dominates the news, right? I mean, it's something that everybody talks about. And I think, you know, one thing to note, you have to remember that if you want to cause chaos in the United States, which is the goal of, you know, a lot of individuals and even nations, you don't actually need to hack the election or change results. You just need to create the appearance that it's possible or create rumors that it happened and then kind of let people fight amongst themselves. That's really, you know, the easiest way to cause chaos.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about if for whatever reason, and I got a stack, I'm on a desk, Alex, I got to be honest, of notices about data breaches from this one or that one or the other one who I thought had the keys of the kingdom, come to find out they didn't and they lost the keys years ago. I've done nothing about any of this. Should I?
So I'll tell you, you are in good company, if I can be considered good company. Because, you know, both my wife and I, you know, got data breaches notifications in the mail this week, and I got one last week. Well, because think about it, right? You don't actually have your data.
Nope.
You know, think about your healthcare data or your shopping data or whatever it is. You know, it's not under your mattress. It's not something that you print out and you can put in the safe. Somebody else has it. And what we see time and time again, it's not just the company with whom you shared that data. They tend to share it with other companies, right? Because they use service providers and so on and so forth. And so it's not uncommon that you get these breach notifications, and it's not even a company that you've ever directly engaged with, right? It's a company that, you know, some retailer or health organization that you use, that company uses this other company, and they had a breach. So it's tough because, you know, if you're listening right now, it's pretty much a guarantee that you've been involved in at least one data breach, you know, probably more over the years. And, you know, so our data is largely out there. So what I would say is I think it's important to think about the types of data that get breached. You know, speaking as a consumer, you know, not as a professional that works with companies, but as a consumer, if your credit card is breached, you know, the credit card company takes care of it. They send out a new one. You don't, you know, generally have any liability. And you move on with your life. But when you start to talk about very personal things like your health care or, you know, information about your emails or things like that, that's when I think we should all be more concerned if those types of things are out there.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I'm getting some questions here from the text line. first steps you should take if you find out you're part of a data breach, and I'm going to share this with you. I was cutting the grass a couple of weeks ago, got a text alert about one of them that happened 5 years ago, and it's like, I'm not going to stop what I'm doing and go do whatever it is you want me to do. It happened 5 years ago, and as you just said, Alex, it's out there. 851 9 till 9. More we come back. Any questions about internet security, scams, etc., 504-260-1870. We'll pass them along to Alex Hammerstone when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. 856, 857, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Alex Hammerstone, our guest, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. So, Alex, if somebody is concerned about a data breach, what should they do? What can they do? I think internet security is something somebody invented to just kind of let them sleep at night, because I think everything's already out there. Am I wrong in that?
I think a lot of it's out there, and so certainly when you think about things like names and addresses, those are certainly out there. Even for most of us, social security numbers at this point have been involved in breaches, and those are pretty widely available. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those are certainly something to know, right? But when it comes to, you know, being involved in a data breach, the thing is that I think we're all involved in so many of them that, you know, kind of the tips are more general, right? They're just things that we should be doing every day. And, you know, one of them is, if you are concerned, you know, certainly freeze your credit. You know, that's something that you can do. You keep people from kind of opening accounts in your name. If you're not regularly, you know, seeking credit, it's not that much of an inconvenience. But also, you know, ensuring that you're using multi-factor authentication or two-factor authentication. So we're all familiar with that, with those codes that are sent to us when we go to log in. So somebody at least needs that extra piece of information if they already have your username and your password.
Refresher on that, Alex, if you will, for the people that are not familiar with two-factor authentication. They might be doing it and not even realize what it is.
Absolutely. So the most common, you know, form that most people are familiar with are the text messages, right? So you go to log into your email account, and you put in your username, and you put in your password, and then it says, you know, we're going to send you a code to your phone, usually. They send that code to your phone, and then you have to enter that code to log in. There are other ways to kind of have multi-factor or two-factor authentication, but the text messaging is really the most common one. So take advantage of that anytime you can, right? Make it more difficult for a hacker or an attacker. That's extremely important. But also things like, you know, I hate to say use common sense, because it implies that we're blaming victims, you know, who you have these things happen to them. But really, when you talk to people that fall victim of a scam, it's extremely common they'll tell you that something fell off, right? Mm-hmm. But scammers, you know, they're very good at what they do, and they'll use a sense of urgency, and people fall for it. So if something feels off, just wait, right? Stop what you're doing and maybe do some research or wait a half an hour. You know, nobody should ever be asking you for your, you know, passwords. Nobody should ever be asking you for bank account information. You know, things that feel like common sense, again, you know, the IRS will never ask you to pay your tax bill with gift cards. That's just not how they do business. So things like that, you know, kind of staying aware.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate your time and your insight as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. And it's from time immemorial, there's no free lunch. And if it seems too good to be true, 99.9% of the times, it's not. We'll take a break, come back, talk about LSU and the Saints. Bobby Hebert is going to join us. We'll talk about the Saints after the 2-1 start, about the injury to, Eric McCoy. We spoke with Dr. David Elias, an orthopedic surgeon with Ortho LA. You can download the Odyssey app, use the rewind feature, and while he didn't know exactly about Eric McCoy, he did talk about the nature of that groin injury surgery, and it sounded pretty painful, I'll tell you what. So we'll talk with Bobby about that. But right now we are joined by Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. How you doing, Wilson?
Doing well. How are you all this morning?
I'm okay, sir. Thanks for taking the time with us. Tell me your thoughts after the UCLA game.
About LSU just broadly, it's a team that is still trying to kind of figure things out.
I'm picking your brain, Wilson.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just a team that's still trying to figure things out at the moment. You know, they've got issues on the defensive side of the ball in terms of giving up explosive plays. And obviously in that game, Harold Perkins goes down, so all of a sudden this team is without its most athletic defensive player, really one of the most athletic defensive players in all of college football, even if Harold hadn't had a great season to this point. That's still a blow to this team and devastating for Perkins himself, too. And, you know, on the offensive side, they're a little bit further ahead, but they've still got some issues they got to iron out too, especially in terms of being able to run the ball on short yardage situations, something they've wanted to do and haven't been able to a consistent level yet to this point. And so they're a team that's, you know, still got hasn't necessarily inspired like a ton of confidence yet, I think, in the fan base going into really after the bye week next week and going into Ole Miss. You know, the SEC schedule is going to pick up, and LSU's got to keep working on some things so that it can be competitive in those SEC games and end up having the kind of season that it would like to.
I'm no Wilson Alexander, but my take on Brian Kelly is that LSU is a lot closer than maybe it may seem, and he knows that. It's hard to tell. You know, a coach has to be positive, right? But I just sense, reading between the lines, that maybe this LSU team has a lot more to deliver, and while you say they're trying to figure themselves out, that Brian Kelly, again, reading between the lines and trying to be a mind reader here, thinks that they're pretty close. Thoughts?
Well, you know, we talked to Whit Weeks. It reminds me of something Whit Weeks told us after the game against UCLA when we were talking to him about some of the defensive breakdowns that they've had, mistakes that Brian Kelly called maddening in the first half. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is all contained within that game anyway, to the first half. And Weeks said, yeah, that's what's frustrating about it, is that we know we have players who are good enough. We have talent. We have, you know, skill. We have good coaches. And yet we're still having some of these sorts of, you know, issues. And Brian Kelly just kind of usually refers to them as sort of mental lapses there in the first half, where things that he has continued to say this season are correctable. And I think that's what's most frustrating to him, is because he does think this can be a good football team, but it's having mistakes that he views as very correctable and things that are avoidable, and that they're still kind of happening. And so it seems like he's been frustrated by that. Again, this is all sort of psychoanalysis in some ways, but it does seem like he thought that this team maybe wouldn't be having some of those sort of mental mistakes, especially at this point of the year, and that he's trying to, that's kind of the thing that he's having to coach around right now, is sort of, okay, these things are still happening. What do we have to do as coaches to get this team, you know, really ready going into the thick of the schedule?
I know whether you're a coach or a parent or a manager at work or whatever it is, there's nothing more frustrating than knowing what's going to happen, telling somebody what's going to happen, telling them what they have to do to keep it from happening. Do you understand what you have to do to keep it from happening? Yes. So you get it, right? Yes. And then when it comes time to prevent that from happening, they don't do it. And that can just be, as Brian Kelly said, maddening.
Yeah, it absolutely can. And, you know, as in college, you're dealing that with a lot on every team. It's 18 to 22-year-olds who you're trying to get to do things a certain way. And Brian Kelly, in particular, is very specific about how he thinks, wants things done within his program. It's all, you know, he preaches accountability all the time. They have to sell these wellness questionnaires every day before noon. And he has always been of the mind that those things are going to help lead to success. And while he says that this is his most accountable team that he's had in terms of filling out those things and doing those things off the field, and that he has seen a shift off the field in terms of how they're playing, which usually in the year three of his program ends up helping kind of lead to a nice jump there in the program and the trajectory of it, that hasn't quite translated to the on-the-field stuff this year yet. And that's what they're still trying to get to, because, you know, he keeps telling them, like, you can do these things, you can be a good team. And so he's kind of having to maybe what he expected coming into the year hasn't quite been there, and he's trying to help coach this team to get it to that point.
Tell me about these wellness questionnaires. What is that?
So that's something that Kelly implemented started back at Notre Dame and brought here to LSU. It's every morning the players have to complete a series of questions. They say it takes about a minute. It's sort of about their sleep, how they felt like the night before, some of the things they're feeling, just kind of like a daily little check-in in that regard. And what Kelly, it gives them some data and especially the strength staff and the nutrition staff, some information on how players are feeling so that they can adjust some things. But it also kind of just, in Kelly's mind, breeds accountability. You know, his sort of thing is that if you can't do this stuff, then why can we trust you on the field? And so they're supposed to complete those every single day. And they've gotten up to a point now where, you know, they're doing that on a regular basis, and which is a good sign for Kelly in terms of what he wants to see in terms of sort of how players are handling themselves off the field in order to make sure that they can be trusted on the field.
Let's talk about Harold Perkins, and he's gone for the season. Is he gone from LSU? Let's start there, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, he hasn't decided yet, and Brian Kelly was asked about that this week. You know, is he leaving? And Kelly said it's premature to have any of those sorts of discussions. talking to some NFL draft analysts this week about what Harold's outlook is now in terms of the NFL. They say that he's still probably a top 50 pick or, like, you know, day two, second day, you know, kind of pick, like basically a second-round pick of some sort. Coming into the season, he was being projected as a late first-rounder, but that was also kind of dependent on the kind of production he had this season. There's still a lot of questions about what his position would be at the next level. And so there's, you know, Harold is still in a position where he could get drafted pretty high there, especially if you're a top 50 pick. That's usually a place where you should probably, you know, go and go ahead and go to the NFL. But, you know, he's going to have a decision to make now that isn't necessarily crystal clear. If in his mind he wants to be an early first-round pick, now that probably wouldn't happen. And so he's still going to have to make that decision, though, and he's got about 4 months to do that. And so there probably won't be anything, you know, anytime soon about what his next plans will be.
In this day and age, it's so hard to keep track of. Some of these guys are in school for 7-8 years, you know, married with kids. I don't know what the hell's going on. He's a junior. He's in his third year. Could he get a medical red shirt for this or not, or is that, you know, on the table at all?
Yeah, he could. I mean, he only played in 4 games. It's not something that I think would necessarily apply too much to Harold, because this isn't a guy who you're expecting anyway to be here for like 5 years.
Right.
You know, even if he were to come back, you know, you wouldn't expect him to then come back the year after that. You know, yes, technically he could apply for a medical redshirt or even just a regular redshirt, because he's never had one of those, and gain an extra year of eligibility. But with someone with his talent, you're not expecting them to take a redshirt, because he's probably not going to be at LSU, you know, long enough for that to apply.
Let's talk about the other part of the first of all, how does this change not having to account for Harold Perkins, how other teams prepare for LSU and the defense?
Brian Kelly was asked about that this week, and he said how, you know, no matter where he was, how he was playing, like, teams had to game plan for him, and quarterbacks had to look for him pre-snap and find out where he was on the field, and that element gets taken away. Again, Harold had only had 17 tackles this year, 1.5 tackles for loss, no sacks, but there was so much potential there to turn into more, to take a step forward, and now we don't get to see if that was ever going to happen this season, to become the disruptive player that everybody knows he can be, and for the last 2 years, LSU's been trying to kind of, you know, get that out of him, put him in the right spot for that to happen, and it hasn't always been put in the right spot for that to happen, and all that. And so, you know, teams are it takes away somebody who's extremely athletic and get after the passer, who can make, who we all know has the ability to make game-changing plays. And so it certainly is a blow to LSU's defense. You're talking about taking the most talented player off the field, really. And so LSU's going to have to adjust. You're going to see probably more of Wes Weeks at linebacker when LSU wants to play 3 linebackers. You're also going to probably see them switch up their formation a little bit, go back to what they call the 4-2-5, and use Major Burns at the star position as in a way to kind of adjust moving forward. Because now, you know, moving forward without Harold is certainly a change to the entire dynamic of the season.
It is a game of adjustment and counter-adjustment, obviously. How big of a difference maker is this for Blake Baker and moving people around? And is it going to be some experimentation going on against South Alabama to get ready for Ole Miss? That's the way this plays out?
Yeah, I would think so. You know, you kind of got this whole first month of the season, college coaches are, if they haven't already figured it out in the preseason, you know, first month in particular, you're trying to understand your personnel. Because you college coaches, you know, you try to have an idea, you know, of what you got going into the year, but you really find out as you start to play games. And so, you know, that kind of was the thing here. You know, LSU's got a month before really going into the thick of its SEC schedule, starting with that big game against Ole Miss. And this is the last chance to do that here against South Alabama. You know, is there any experimentation that they want to get done? Is there anybody who they really want to get a test of how they look? You know, that'll probably happen in this game. At the same time, though, LSU can't do too much of that, because this is a South Alabama team that could, you know, it's played really well, especially on offense, the last couple of weeks. And, you know, so LSU has got to be able to play its best. Otherwise, you know, it can get hairy there in Tiger Stadium on Saturday nights. But they're still probably going to try to, you know, figure out a little bit, especially I think in the secondary at safety, who can they rely on as they move forward.
Yeah, linebacker is not a really deep position for LSU, right?
No, it's not. You've got the 3 sort of players who are going to be in the rotation right now, which are the Weeks brothers and senior Greg Penn. And then it's 3 true freshmen, and none of them have played a defensive snap yet in terms of scholarship players. And, you know, that's Xavier Atkins, Talon Singleton, and Devon Keyes. And, again, none of them have played a defensive snap yet. But Kelly said that Xavier Atkins would possibly be activated now to be one of the kind of primary backups but it's still somebody who has never actually put a defensive snap in college.
Let's talk about, before we take a break and then move over to the offensive side of the football, corners and safeties. What the hell's going on there?
Well, a lot of rotation at safety. LSU still seems to be trying to figure things out of that position. It's the one that's most in flux right now on the defense. They've got a bunch of guys rotating. Like I said, it's Major Burns, it's Jordan Allen, it's Jardon Gilbert, Sage Ryan, Deshaun Spears, a freshman. So they've got, and now with Major Burns probably going back to the star position, you really got kind of four guys in that rotation who are, nobody has really sort of like asserted themselves as a super reliable player who needs to be playing like every down. And so they're still trying to figure things out there. Deshaun Spears, though, the freshman, has started the past two games. And then at corner, Zy Alexander suffered a concussion against UCLA, and so his status is questionable for South Alabama. But as he's coming off of an ACL injury, he looks like one of their starters alongside Ashton Stamps. There's a little bit more stability there at corner. But as Brian Kelly has said, they don't necessarily have two guys who they can just play every single play. So J.K. Johnson's getting some playing time out there, as well as B.J. Woodland, one of the freshmen. But really, Ashton Stamps has definitely solidified himself as a starter, and he's got a guy who's got some of the most snaps on the field this season.
So I guess I'm wondering, how can it go from, I'm not the first guy to say this, from DBU to DB who?
Well, it's been recruiting over the years, recruiting misses, losing guys. Really, after Corey Raymond left, LSU was having a really tough time getting top recruits to come. And those four-star, those really high four-star, five-star guys. And you started to see that change in the 2025 class, especially with five-star DJ Pickett being committed. Now that Corey Raymond has come back, the recruiting seems to have improved. But that's kind of why it dropped off. At the end of the Ed Orgeron era there, I think a bunch of guys transferred. And the guys who came in just haven't been at the same level that LSU is accustomed to seeing. And so recruiting is going to have to be the thing that returns them to that DBU status.
Yeah, and you watch a game. We'll take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back about DBU, LSU quarterback you. When you look at Jaden Daniels and Joe Burrow dueling out on Monday Night Football, two Heisman Trophy winners. But that got me to thinking about Garrett Nussmeier and who's behind him. And Garrett's looked good, but it's just, one play away from disaster. And you got to wonder what's going on behind Garrett Nussmeier. And also we'll talk about running backs, wide receivers, and more offensive line. When we return with Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. Any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. It's the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line. I'll pass them along when we come back. Tommy Tucker, glad you're with us, talking LSU football. And then later on, we'll talk to the Cajun Cannon, Bobby Hebert, here on WWL. 928, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. We're going to move over to the offensive side of the football, and we'll talk to Bobby Hebert later on, this hour co-host. You know who Bobby Hebert is, about the Saints season and more. So when Garrett Nussmeier limped off against Nicholls, my immediate question is, what happens now? He was okay, he came back, but you know how it works, Wilson. You're always just, and I'm not, shouldn't say this because I don't. Joe Buck the other night on Monday Night Football, after a guy missed a field goal, said, he hadn't missed in 29 times, but I didn't say that before, so don't blame it on me. And I know what I say here has nothing to do with anything, and I hope to God Garrett Nussmeier is healthy and happy for the rest of his life. But God forbid, if something should happen, where does LSU stand at quarterback behind him?
Well, it's either Ricky Collins or A.J. Swan, and Ricky Collins came in through, actually completed the pass when Garrett Nussmeier went out for a moment earlier this season, but it's still a little bit unclear exactly, who would play if LSU had to do something, long-term. Garrett's injury was, if Garrett had an injury that caused him to, miss multiple weeks or something like that, because there was some discussion there, according to the broadcast crew, that A.J. Swan is probably going to redshirt this season, and so LSU might not want to activate him. But if, all of a sudden Garrett was going to miss half the year in this hypothetical scenario where everybody should be knocking on wood, A.J. Swan, maybe would get activated in that. But it's still kind of in flux week to week exactly who the backup is. Again, I think in Ricky Collins is probably the one most likely to enter in a brief scenario so that they can get A.J. a red shirt. It would have to be something where Garrett was missing a significant amount of time, I think, for that to probably change.
But to be clear, there is nobody close to Garrett Nussmeier behind him.
No, not at this moment. Ricky Collins needs a lot more development. So does A.J. Swan. Ricky has certainly improved from what we saw last year in practices. His throwing motion looks cleaner, sharper, making better decisions. But Garrett is right now playing at a level that's making him one of the best quarterbacks in the SEC, and potentially over the course of the year, one of the best quarterbacks in the country. I mean, he's tied for second in the country in touchdown passes right now with 13, and there is nobody else in this roster. Nobody who could replicate what he's doing right now.
Let's talk about wide receiver. What's going on there?
Well, you know, Chris Hilton might return this week after missing the first four games. He's really been out for about 5 weeks now with an ankle injury. And he warmed up against UCLA but didn't actually end up playing. Brian Kelly said it was a game-time decision. He wasn't really ready to go yet, but that this could finally be the week where he returns. And if so, as Kelly said, that this could give LSU a little bit more of a vertical threat. The one thing that it hasn't quite had in the passing game is consistent downfield ability to throw the football. And not that it's Garrett lacking for arm talent. We all know that's not the case. He threw a beautiful pass to Kyle Parker down the right sideline, 45-yard touchdown that UCLA game, and we've seen it throughout his career. But, you know, LSU's wide receivers, none of them have the speed that Hilton has vertically down the field. And so right now, Nussmeier is 9 of 20 on passes thrown more than 20 yards downfield, and Chris Hilton might be able to change that. Outside of him, Aaron Anderson has had a fantastic start to the season, emerged as someone who else you can trust, one of Garrett's go-to receivers. Tyron Lacy's had a couple of drops, but has otherwise been pretty good, and especially in key moments as someone who Garrett looked for. C.J. Daniels has done some decent things so far. Xavier Thomas has been involved. But really, when you talk about the receivers, you have to also talk about Mason Taylor, the tight end, who leads the team with 25 receptions at the moment. Is putting together right now what could be the best season by a tight end in LSU history, and certainly deserves quite a bit of recognition.
He is a stud. Talking about what's going on in running back, have we sorted any of that out? Still going to be committed?
Well, not really. Still going to be by committee. You know, it seemed like Caden Durham would be more involved against UCLA after what he did against South Carolina, and then Josh Williams ends up having 13 carries for a little over 60 yards and a touchdown. And Josh played pretty well, you know, so you can understand why maybe LSU would kind of in some ways ride the hot hand. But Caden Durham showed on the 35-yard touchdown catch in the second half what he can do when he touches the football. He's done something good pretty much every time he touches the football, especially the last 2 weeks. So you'd expect him to become more of this part of this rotation, begin to get more touches and workload moving forward. We know they have a lot of trust in Josh. And he was doing some things against UCLA in terms of moving the pile, turning his feet, picking up extra yardage. But Caden is a little bit different in terms of his speed and what he can do when he gets out in space in particular. And so, you know, Cale Jackson showed some good things, too, against UCLA there in the second half. A few nice runs, just sort of being a little bit more physical than he had been the first few weeks. So it's certainly going to be those three guys moving forward. But Caden Durham, I think, will only continue to carve out more of a role within that rotation.
And, you know, you talk about Caden Durham, and I got a sense of Harold Perkins' VU in a way here in terms of you got a guy here, but you're not going to use him, and then we're going to start fooling around. And do you understand what I'm trying to say, Wilson?
No, could you
Well, I guess what I'm saying is Harold Perkins Jr., like in freshman year, was like crazy, right? Like just going all over the place, disruptive, making plays, then decided to start tinkering around. It's like you had an asset and you didn't use it, then you decided to use it a different way. Unfortunately, he gets injured. Seems like with Caden Durham, you find your guy, but now you're going to find a reason not to use him.
Yeah, you know, that it has kind of happened a few times now. Like last year, you think about sort of a similar thing with Whit Weeks.
Yeah.
Where, you know, he was having this great freshman year where he saw, like, wow, he's making a difference because he's just playing with his hair on fire, even if he's sometimes a little bit out of position. And then he would get taken off the field, even though he was the one who was really making the most of a difference. And that whole defense was broken. But it was still kind of a similar sort of thing. You know, when it comes to freshmen in particular, Brian Kelly obviously hasn't been afraid to play freshmen. Go back to his first year, LSU was starting four of them. But also in times when he has said in the past, if he thinks everything else is equal, then he's going to take the guy with the most experience. And that might be kind of what you're seeing at running back here, too. Josh Williams is a guy who's a six-year senior who LSU trusts in a lot of different ways, especially pass protection and kind of being that third-down back. But as Caden Durham continues to prove to the staff that he can handle more, he'll probably get on the field more. But it is kind of unusual that, okay, this guy just almost rushed for 100 yards in his SEC debut, and then wasn't as heavily involved a week later. was kind of strange. And so it's just something to continue to kind of watch here for a little bit. If it's kind of similar against South Alabama, I think people will really be scratching their heads because, again, he had a 35-yard touchdown catch there against UCLA, and he's done nothing but, you know, make plays since he's gotten on the field the last couple of weeks.
And you mentioned the broadcast team. I heard them mention that, you know, Caden Durham could be on the LSU track team, which is a pretty good track team. So there's no substitute for speed, and he handles the ball well, so I don't know. We'll see. Thank you, Wilson. I appreciate your insights and your time.
Thank you for having me.
Talk to you again soon. Hey, you too. Wilson Alexander, LSU beat writer for The Advocate. When we come back, we're talking to Cajun Cannon. Bobby Hebert, man, I love talking to that guy. 9:35, 25 till 10, traffic, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by the Cajun Cannon. Bobby Hebert, talk about the Saints season so far. How you doing, Bobby?
All right, Tommy, how you doing?
I'm all right.
I'm glad the hurricane's going to the right.
I was just looking at a tweet from somebody from Florida State saying an exact thing, because Tallahassee's pretty much in the crosshairs, but it's a big storm, and they're saying it's going to affect a lot of areas. And I was wondering about the Tampa Bay game on Sunday. They host, I forgot who it is, but I guess they'll get it in.
Yeah, I want to say, they'll get it in by Sunday. I should have remembered that because I think it's a significant game. Yeah, the Eagles. Yeah, and the Eagles are beat up. Look, their two top receivers are out, and everyone's dealing with injuries. Tommy, look at the 49ers. They're like a mass unit.
You know,
all of a sudden, I was thinking like Christian McCaffrey.
That's what I was thinking of, too, with Christian McCaffrey and comparing that to Alvin Kamara and talking about who got paid and who didn't. And I'm thinking, you know what, AK is still playing, right?
Yeah, he's still playing. And and to show you that it's much more than we think or they let on the public, they're sending him to Germany to get treatment. What is some not FDA approved or stem cell? I don't know what it is, but that sounds like a serious calf injury if you're going all the way to Germany to get that fixed. So
let's talk about
the Saints have injuries too. So
yeah, that game on Sunday was hard hitting. Eagles, like you're saying, put some people on injured reserve as well. That was one of the harder hitting games you've seen in a while.
Yeah, especially in the trenches, and the Saints were even fortunate to be in that game. But you know, you can have ugly wins. You know, like you always say, the cliche, like, boy, we could have stole that game. Because really, the Eagles deserve to win. I always look at how they won in the trenches, on the offensive and defensive line. But we had an opportunity at the end. I tell you what, if we'd have beat the Eagles, they might have fired the head coach after the game.
After that decision-making. Man.
Yes. I mean, like, what in the world? But, think how meaningful come of Sunday. And just really the next 3 weeks, and I can say 2 out of 3 weeks, I realistically look at, we beat the Chiefs, great, they're the Super Bowl champs, they're trying to go for three-peat on Monday night. But if you can tell me right now we lose to the Chiefs and beat Atlanta and Tampa Bay when they come to the Dome, we'd be 3-0 in the NFC South. Think about all that momentum. And I don't know, I look at Vegas, where they have the Falcons like a 1.5-point favorite, so you have a flip a coin, you know, their center's out, our center's out. And I always look at this, Tommy, that it seems like what Atlanta are, in general, even college, like rivalry-type games, it doesn't matter if the Saints are good and the Falcons aren't, or vice versa. When you get a rivalry-type game, I almost look at that, that it's a split. And I always say, to win the NFC South, not ultimately you want to go undefeated, if not 5-1, but if you're 4-2, you're in the hunt. So obviously you want to kick Carolina while they're down, split with Atlanta, split with Tampa Bay, at the least. Then you 4-2, then you have a chance to win your division and host a playoff game. But we've always played well in Atlanta, so it's going to be interesting. Again, what's going to happen in the trenches? I think that's a major loss for the Saints and McCoy. He's our best lineman, and we had questions about our line in August. And so, I mean, it was kind of what we expected would happen against Philadelphia compared to the first two games. But you got to give Vic Fangio, their defensive coordinator, a lot of credit. They were not going to let the Saints run against them. And so that game could be won and lost in the trenches. And even though, like I said, Atlanta's out with their center, if you look at overall, that was kind of considered one of their strengths. The Falcons have a better offensive line than the Saints. So I look at right now, it doesn't matter when you play a team, who's playing, who's available, who's healthy and all that. I think if the Saints win in Atlanta, it'll be an upset. Now, what does that mean? You win by a field goal? You just got to win. We don't have to crush nobody and score 40 points. But, you know, you got to just, you know, break down the season. And we used to always do this with 16 games, like four quarters. And I said this in August. If we could be 3-3 to start the season, I still would be optimistic. And right now, since the way we beat Dallas and started the season, even though how we lost to the Eagles, I'd be disappointed if we're not like a 4-2 type team.
Yeah, I think people need to pay attention to what's important and not get so involved with Kansas City and realize that, and I know you know this, but about why Atlanta and Tampa Bay are so much more important. Like, if you're going to lose one out of the three, lose the game to Kansas City, not the other two.
Yeah, because it's the AFC. That's why to kick off the season, I said it was a must-win, even though it was week one. Carolina, it's like 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out 1-0 in the, NFC South. And the one thing now that's bad about losing to the Eagles, because you never know how the season's going to unfold, you lose the tiebreaker to them, because that's the conference game, that's the NFC. So, yeah, in theory, if you're going to lose games during the season, obviously, you know, who that nation would want to win them all. But you lose those AFC games and win those NFC or divisional games, because that's where it's going to put you where you want to be at the end of the season.
Tell me about DeMario Davis. We know anything about him? Injury-wise.
I don't know, Tom. Yeah, injury-wise, I know in that long run by Saquon Barkley, you know, he came back in the game, if I can recall. Mm-hmm. And I think he got lost in the wash. He took a bad angle. So did Lattimore on that play. That they made Saquon like he was on a different level. But Saquon Barkley is a special running back, and you saw that. I don't know why the hell the Giants let him go. But DeMario Davis, I still think he has a lot left in the tank, but, you know, you look how fast Cam Jordan has fallen. He's not even in the top two defensive ends right now. He's in the rotation. You know, he went from playing, when we always counted on Cam Jordan, to high 80s or 90% of the snaps, to right now he's like about 25% of the snaps. And then DeMario Davis, I still think, has a lot left, and he'll finish strong. But if you're dealing with an injury, that makes you old really fast, mm-hmm. especially when you can't run like you want to run. So I don't know the extent of the injury. That would be a good question come right for the game, and I'm sure Deuce can find out some scoop with that. Because we need DeMario Davis, the quarterback of the defense, the captain and all that stuff. And we need him to be ready to roll, because he's a big part what we do defensively, and the lead, not only the leadership, but his physical ability. The two players that have played outstanding, I think, on defense, and you can see the young one and now the one that's a veteran, is Carl Granderson. Oh. Carl Granderson is amongst the best in the whole NFL, every down defensive end. And then Brian Brzee, what he's done in the interior. Now, there's something he can get better against the run, but he is disruptive as a pass rusher. So they have played at a high level. I think Alante Taylor's been very active. We need Marshawn Lattimore to be more impactful, you know, not now that he's back. But it's going to be a challenge against Atlanta. You know, from a national perspective, everyone says, oh, Atlanta's going to win the division. I'd say, well, they're kind of disregarding Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay has won it three straight seasons, and look at the start they got to. But then Sean Payton spanked him. But it seems like Sean Payton and his teams in his office, he's always had success against Tampa Bay teams. Mm-hmm. So when you look at that trend there, so I don't know, Tom, it is wide open in the NFC. Think about this. You might say, well, the 49ers are still maybe the team to beat, but they are so beat up. Mm-hmm. And the Rams are so beat up. And then the Rams upset them last week. And speaking of the Rams, we're not going to have McCoy back until December the 1st when we mm-hmm. play the Rams. So that's basically eight games, 2 months. So it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough, but you got to take it one game at a time. And I'm telling you, this is, again, like a playoff game like Carolina was to start the season, because, boy, it'd be awesome to win at Atlanta and start out 2-0 in the NFC South.
You know it's going to come down to a field goal. It seems like it always does.
Right. And both kickers can make a 50-yard, you know, 50-yard. So we just need to be in that position. Kawhi there, I think that's a Korean kicker they have. He's cool. Been cool. Yeah, what I say, Kawhi. Cool. Yeah, he's been not as automatic as he's been you know, in the past, but he's had ups and downs, but he's a reliable kicker. Like, I think Groupie, when the games are the line, they're going to make it.
I know it's only three games in the season, but it's only a 17-game season. You're going to be almost a fourth of the way through after the Atlanta game. Then you look ahead. You got Kansas City, then Tampa Bay, then you come back Thursday night against Denver. If you had to look at that Bobby Hebert crystal ball and see on Thursday, October 17th, coming into the Dome to take on Sean Payton Thursday night against the Colts, where do you think the Saints are?
I'm hoping, and I think it's going to happen, because 4-2.
Okay.
4-2, and I expect this to beat the Broncos and be 5-2. So at worst, I would say 3-3 going into that the Denver game. But I still think, I'm telling you, we're going to be hovering, like a lot of NFL teams, around 500. The NFL loves all this parity.
Mm-hmm. They do.
There's not, like, if to get the double-digit wins, you might think this sounds drastic, but 10-7 and 7-10 is not that much difference.
You know,
when you go look at the handful of plays that occur. But boy, it sure is. Everybody's going to get fired if you're 7-10. Then if you're 10-7, everyone's optimistic.
You know, not to ask you, do you think from when you played, injuries are becoming more prevalent? Is it because they're more concerned about injuries than they used to be? Is it because of the longer season? Is it because of the physics of bigger, faster, stronger? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, the physics, that could come in bigger, faster, stronger. But concern, I think, a lot of times the money was involved, so, I mean, you have to play hurt or they get somebody else. And then concussions, like Devontae Smith, who he knocked out. I mean, that was a brutal hit. The Eagles receiver. But in the past, he might be playing this weekend, where now he might be out a whole month. So, you know, I think they're trying to make the game safer, but it is, a violent sport. But when I look at the 17 games, Tommy, in the early 80s, and those was the USFL, and there was a lot of NFL players like Reggie White and all them, Steve Young, Jim Kelly. We played 18 games. We played 18 games in the spring and the summer. So, listen, the money's always going to control that.
Yep.
But I just think now the 24/7, how it's instant, social media and all that, we find out more about injuries to the public in general and compared to maybe what might be hidden, you know, the injury report. But now with gambling and fantasy football and all that, well, they're treating that as like almost you can't do drugs or gambling, I should say, before they had that legal.
Like a state secret.
Boy, you better not be lying on that injury report.
Thank you, Bobby. Appreciate it as always, man. Take it easy. We'll talk to you again soon, Bobby Hebert. We'll take a break, come back, find out what Newell Norman's got planned today on WWL.